Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is episode 74, and we're continuing our discussion of Dark Age, the fifth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Nick, and this episode covers Mustang's POV chapters from Treason and Pride, parts 3 and 4 of Dark Age.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
That said, don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Though, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon, which offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes within 24 hours of us recording them, and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
Okay, so despite the rumors that have been bandied about by Seffi and Atalantia, turns out that Mustang is not, in fact, dead. Though, let's be real, there are some points of these chapters where it's hard not to wish, at least a little bit, that she was, because for the most part, this is her darkest timeline. Sort of everyone's darkest timeline. After all, when we meet back up with her, she's having her memories drawn from her by means of the Pandemonium Chair. And her being the Sovereign, those memories include hiding places, secret bases, fleet orders, doomsday protocols, nuclear launch codes. We could go on and on, but the good news is, sorta, maybe, that the pyrotechs they are using to extract this information are no match for the conditioning Mustang went through to prevent anyone from being able to get real, true information from her. But that's kinda where the sorta maybe good news ends, because Mustang realizes that Lilith has used the psycho spikes to paralyze her body and disable her language abilities. Oh, and they also hijack the dopamine and oxytocin levels of her brain so that she's happy when she should be furious. Cool. Especially as her captors then make her watch the executions of so many of her remaining friends who die, crushed under the weight of a huge stone obelisk. At least until Publius interrupts her regular viewing with his big corrupted asshole speech about how it's totes fine that he allied with the Syndicate Queen, and goes on to tell Mustang about all the plans he has for getting rid of the Syndicate and remaking the world. Like, sure, good luck with that, dude. Seriously, Publius definitely spoke too soon, because before he can show Mustang the justice of the meek, who drops in but Lilith with a group of bone riders? While Mustang is obviously not surprised, Publius sure is. But while some of the other Vox senators present protest and lose their lives for the effort, Publius crawls to Lilith like the dog he is and eats brain. Only it's not really Lilith who's in charge, y'all, because she announces, "My Emperor, your slaves await," and Mustang knows the voice that responds all too well, because the voice belongs to an abomination wearing the face of a 10-year-old boy who calls her sister. Guys, it's a clone of the Jackal, in case that wasn't yet clear. But also, what the fuck? And listen, it somehow only gets worse, because soon Severo, Pebble, and Clown are dragged before the Abomination, hereafter known as the Abominatrius, per the fandom, by the way, who tells them the story of how he came to be. You see, the Jackal wasn't sure he would be able to wrest control of the Sovereignty from Octavia, so he left Lilith instructions, DNA samples. Oh, and instructions for his future self, because one can never be too careful. P.S., Lilith apparently proved her loyalty by growing Abominatrius in her womb, the news of which literally causes Severo to throw up. We're with you, dude. The show continues with Abominatrius revealing that Lilith has been working with Atalantia and Atlas, and that the reason they were able to orchestrate all the things is because the Pachelbel birds that flit off over the Citadel, you know, the one Sophocles kept trying to kill, are some sort of sophisticated spyware. Mustang hears all of this and remains silent, but Severo, of course, does not. Unfortunately, his mouthing off leads to some Syndicate thorns appearing with a giant iron statue of a howling wolf. A statue that is stuffed with several actual howlers who Abominatrius orders roasted alive right in front of everyone before then threatening Victra and Severo's daughters.
At this point, rightfully so, Severo breaks and lunges for the clone, but he's beaten within an inch of his life. Mustang finally tells Abominadrius to just kill them and end this ridiculous show, but he insists that his family, she, deserves a second chance, which leads to her being the guest of honor at a Bone Rider banquet. The worst kind of banquet, if we're honest. However, as awful as having to sit through this so-called banquet is for Mustang, doing so does allow her to watch and learn. She quickly realizes that Lilith is a suffocating sycophant with the clone and wonders how long he will be able to watch the Bone Rider's depravity before coming to the conclusion his adult self made very quickly, that they're loathsome and only worthy of mockery. Mustang does, in fact, get her chance to start sowing seeds of doubt thanks to the fact that Abominadrius throws some puzzles at her and is surprised and delighted when she solves them, allowing her to inform him that it used to anger him when she solved his puzzles. Lilith, of course, busts into the conversation to insist that Mustang always thought her brother was a monster, that she, in fact, hated him, to which Mustang replies, "If I hated him, why did I pull his feet? If I didn't love him, why would I keep those puzzles?" Only Abominadrius doesn't know that Mustang kept his puzzles because, despite him ordering that her quarters be left as they were, Lilith hid the puzzles from him. He orders that they be restored to their original places, and then they take a little field trip to Mustang's office, where he demands that Lilith leave them, and proceeds to question Mustang, while also readily submitting to her questions, admitting that the Bone Riders are ridiculous and that he totally plans to kill Lilith someday. I mean, good, but also, wow, this child is fucked up. And while Mustang knows there is a patient, longer scheme available to her, she also understands that she doesn't really have time to follow through with something like that. So she lures him close by teasing him about how he hasn't yet cracked how to really use the pandemonium chair, and then plucks a night lily from a nearby vase of flowers, holding it out to him as a Bellona knight would to a loved one when returning from war. And, you know, being a spoiled 10-year-old who hasn't spent enough time outdoors, Abominadrius grabs hold of it, roughly. Oh, and night lilies, BT dubs, do not abide rough handling. The flower suddenly bursts with necrotic needles, and while they do prick Mustang, the clone gets the lion's share of the poison. See what I did there? Knowing she has little time to escape, Mustang fights the poison's effects and drags her partially paralyzed body toward the puzzle wall and toward the secret tunnel that exists behind it, but can only be opened if one of the puzzles is there for her to press. When Lilith bursts in and attacks, Mustang fights back as best she can, eventually throwing first the flower and then her hatchet at the other woman. This buys her enough time to dive into the tunnel, which deposits her into a secret bunker that, thankfully, her enemies had yet to find. She calls Kavix and immediately offers to go back for the other prisoners if he thinks she can reach them. But once he sees her injuries, the answer to that is a resounding no. Regretting every moment of what she does, Mustang crawls into the escape compartment. Despite it spitting her into the center of a Vox Mobile Infantry Legion headquarters, Holiday comes to the rescue at the head of a special forces troop, and as their escape shuttle lands on Kavix's ship, Mustang finally passes out. While she first awakens to an excited Sophocles and the comfort of Darrow's mother, when Mustang has worked up the strength to see others, they don't have much in the way of good news to tell her. Heliopolis will soon fall. They don't know what's up with Darrow. Pax has been abducted by Ephraim yet again. The Pandora was hit and Victra is missing. Archgovernor of Mars Rolla was assassinated. Their current fleet is nowhere near strong enough to help with the whole Mercury problem. Oh, and the Rim has made a secret alliance with the Corps. In the end, regrouping on Mars is basically their only option. But Kavix does have at least one piece of hopeful news. He sent someone to Mercury to bring Darrow home.
And so Mustang returns home herself. And while she is grateful for the help that was sent to Darrow on Mercury, deep down she knows she had no choice but to leave Severo and Clown and Pebble behind on Luna. While she knows that she made the right choice in, quote, running away, unquote, listen, her words, not ours, she feels undeserving of her welcome back to Mars. Oh, and she's definitely worried about facing Victra, feeling bad about allowing the Obsidian to take Chimeria, only to see it ravaged, and wondering if her nostalgia for her home planet stems from missing her innocence. Listen, it's not a great time for Mustang, for, you know, obvious freaking reasons, and it doesn't help that even the indomitable Kavix, Telemannus, is at a physical and mental low point. And yet even a short conversation between the two of them perks both of them up just a bit. You know, for Kavix to suggest that they run an iron circle around the planet. Okay, we've never heard of this before, but apparently the Iron Circle was popularized by good old Selenius Ah Loon, who would fly a shuttle without escort in a ring around a planet or moon upon his arrival to prove he owned said planet or moon. So it's basically a circle piss without the piss, I guess. Yeah. Thing is, Mustang reluctantly agrees to do the thing, and in the midst of their circle piss, oh, sorry, Iron Circle, they see lines of fire racing across the Martian landscape, lines that must be hundreds of feet long to be seen at their height, lines that form the shape of a sling blade. Listen, if you don't get chills over that, why are you even still reading these books? Anyway, when they land in Aegea, millions of people wait to greet them. People who raise clenched fists that have been dipped in red. There to greet them is Pax, her son, taller, scarred, with eyes that no longer gleam in childish wonder, but are dull with his passage into wisdom. Mustang wants to gather him in her arms, kiss him, and apologize to him, but she believes that because they are at war and she is the sovereign, she must wait her turn. Thankfully, Kavix breaks from their procession and, laughing like a madman, scoops up Pax, perches the boy on his shoulder, and crows about the boy who killed a torch ship. Kavix for the win, y'all. Mustang meets with Kieran, is debriefed on all the things, such as they are, gets a brief moment alone with her son, and then finally goes to find Victra, who, being Victra, is working on her feelings by training like a woman possessed. And when Victra sees that Mustang is there, she has just one question. Does Mars ride for Luna? Which, of course, they can't do. And really, Victra knows that, but she still comes at Mustang with a litany of accusations, chief amongst which is her reminder that Mustang abandoned Sevro to Abominadrius. Yo, this is Mustang. And she's not only badass, she's smart as fucking hell. So she just strips off her tops to show Victra her scars, divots in her stomach made by Lilith's hatchet, and hundreds of punctures on her flanks and arms, courtesy of the Vox Populi mob. More scars than even Victra herself has now. Victra then clutches Mustang's shoulder and pulls her close to swear that even if they cannot save their men, they will avenge them. But how many times do we have to remember, y'all, that this book is called Dark Age? Needless to say, their sweet moment, for lack of a better term, is short-lived, because Pax rushes in with a data pad to announce that now Earth has fallen to both the Rim and the Society remnants, claiming that Loon, a.k.a. that bitch Lysander, has bridged the divide. Fuck!
Oh, this book.
It was tough to read, and I will honestly say that I understand what he was doing. I understand why he did it. I still think it was a mistake. I don't think you should shovel quite this much onto everybody in the same book.
Yeah, even Golden Sun wasn't this dark, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I know I keep making this comparison, but imagine if we'd had Ned's death and the Red Wedding in the same book. No one would have read the series. We all would have gone, okay, no, I'm out. But here's hoping that Lightbringer is at least slightly better.
Everything Mustang was experiencing via the pandemonium chair and psycho spikes when we first see her again is awful, but the executions are honestly something else.
She sees that they have turned the Sons of Ares monument an obelisk so that Darrow's first wife, Io, is in the place of honor and thinks about how she always felt jealousy toward the dead girl because she knew Darrow back when all he wanted was to love and be loved. Darrow has loved me, truly loved me in a way that cannot exist outside of wartime, yet that love reflects a gold love, not the red love that consumes the self, a love I can never feel. My brain has always been too far ahead of my heart, but even then I cannot help but think that Io loved him less than he deserved.
She's probably not wrong there, based on what we know from Deanna and even Darrow to an extent. So there's that.
Yeah.
Then she has to watch Theodora die first. A woman who was grown in a tank, who was raised with Cupid's kiss to understand that pain is relieved only by sexual obedience. A woman who survived decades of sexual humiliation to become a glorified maid and then chose to follow a young man at war with the world. Not because she believed he would win, but because he was the first man to fight for her. She fought for him, and as the stone comes down, she's flattened by a marble monument dedicated to the dream she lived for.
And I know that a lot of people die in this scene. We only get two actual named ones. I'll get into the second one in a moment. But Theodora's death was hard to read about.
There have been a lot of hard deaths to read about. I mean, there were some hard deaths to read about in the previous trilogy, but in this tetralogy, also Publius, my dude. If your socialist revolution includes killing pinks like Theodora and not, say, the Hand.
Oh, yeah. We'll get into that a little more.
Oh, I know. I know we're going to talk about him.
Seriously. Exactly. Exactly. She's being killed by the Vox Populi, essentially a socialist movement. I'm not necessarily saying anything bad about the movement itself, at least when it had Dancer at its head. But even though Theodora was one of Darrow and Mustang's like right-hand people, essentially. They had many right-hand people. They have many right hands, I guess. Yes. But she was their, I mean, this is Darrow after all. She was their right-hand spy. And while I'm sure there were things that she did that weren't great, I mean, in fact, we know there were things she did that weren't great. Mm-hmm. She kept the oracles around when Mustang specifically told her not to. We learned about that in Iron Gold. She wasn't working for gold to uplift gold. And that's just what makes this even more sad, is that they're so blinded, I guess, by their own hypocrisy that they don't even see what they're doing.
I want to contest that just a bit, because I don't think the Vox Populi movement as a movement is being hypocritical. I think they've been fed a bunch of crap from the people who are ostensibly in charge, looking at just the surface facts. And if anything, I think this is where Darrow and Virginia really fell down, because obviously there's going to be people that they're saying they're lying anyway, but I think that they've been a little bit more transparent about everything that was going on. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, look, I'm sorry, we are still fighting this war. We have to continue to fight this war, et cetera, et cetera. Are we slower with some of the social reforms? Yes. Should we have beat the living shit out of Quicksilver when he pulled that bullshit with the Red Mines? Yes, we should have. But we, swear to God, are not trying to be gold. We are really trying to help.
Yeah, but again, killing a pink is still, that should be against... Because pinks are one of the lower, low colors. They're sex slaves. Even if Theodora rose high in what they deemed to be the wrong government, despite what they were fed, I still feel like there is a modicum of hypocrisy there.
Like somebody somewhere should have gone, maybe we don't. We can't even afford them a dignified death. Smash her beneath an obelisk.
Yeah.
Mmm.
In front of a shit ton of people. I don't know how many people were like alive there watching, but they're also broadcasting it. And the only other person who's specifically named is Alexander Arcos's mother, Servilla. I mean, okay, so she's a gold, but she wasn't a Senate member. So it was literally just, she is a gold. That's it, as far as I know. I mean, yes, she's probably high up. She might have some duties or whatever that she attends to because she's an Arcos, but like, I don't know. And we have to imagine that the others on this gifts, which were members of Mustang's Lion Guard and her household, senators, Sky Hall officers, and more, follow, because that's just the litany of people that Mustang lists who are waiting to be killed. But any further descriptions are interrupted by Publius the Totally Corrupted's blatherings. Wah, 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 Virginia, I looked up to you once. Oh, boo-hoo, you think I allied with a monster. I'm totally acting like I'm a truly good socialist when really I'm at best an early Soviet-era communist.
Again, the idea that at any point, well, it's okay for us to kill Dancer and then lie about it in order to get this off the ground. That also, I just, the problem is, there's too many, my first thought was, okay, how did they make this happen? They had way too many things go right.
Also, I would have preferred for Publius to actually have been like secretly evil than to pull this, oh, I'm not evil. I'm actually the one playing the Syndicate Queen, and I've got one up on her, so there.
I do definitely like the one thing when Lilith comes in and starts stripping off her prosthetics or whatever, and he goes, she's gold? Like, just you idiot.
But also, it's the same kind of like willful ignorance that Lysander has and absolutely fucking disgusts me.
Yeah. And I don't think we're going to get that moment from Lysander. I don't. I want it so bad. I
Man, fuck Lysander.
I know. But I just want to read his reaction when, to pull the phrase from the Bible, the scales drop from his eyes and he realizes that he's been a complete shithead this whole time for nothing.
I think if we didn't get that in this book, we're not going to get it. We'll get to Lysander in a future episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of like what happens at the end of this book in a future episode and why I don't think we're going to get the scales falling from his eyes at any point. I think he's just going to become worse and worse and worse. Yeah. But we'll get there. He's the worst. Fuck that dude. It's fine.
Footnote, because I have been talking about this a lot. This is the scene. These are the chapters where Mustang has the psycho spikes in and her hormone levels are all wrong. And she's watching this and she goes, oh, that blue guy's kind of attractive. I wonder if he'd be okay. No, probably not. Darrow's super hung and I like that. And I was kind of like, Piers? Also, congratulations to Cassius, you know, I assume. But Piers, did we need that information? I was just like, look, I don't Piers know where this is coming from.
Very specific interests and we don't kink shame.
Yeah. All right, fair enough. Although the one thing I will say about Darkest Timeline and such, I was so freaking relieved when they didn't turn Mustang into a puppet because I would have bet that's where this was going.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. We'll get into more about what actually happens to her because it's hilarious that they don't actually know how to use the machine the way she does. Apparently, it seems like Octavia didn't even know how to use it the way she does, as I think we mentioned in our last Virginia episode. I do want to touch on something real quick just because we were talking about Day of the Red Doves, because this is a reference that I missed all this time that I just put two and two together. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I am, because Pierce has made Star Trek references before, although they were a lot more vague, like the, what was it, the Roddenberry something equation or whatever.
Yeah.
When they're talking about aliens in Morningstar. Yeah. So the Day of the Red Doves is what they call the coup. And the reason for that is like the togas with the blood on them. There's actually a Star Trek original series episode called Day of the Dove. And it features the Klingon and the Federation are stuck on a ship together. And of course, we all know that they're longtime adversaries. But this entity kind of takes over the ship and it basically plants false information to make these people who are actually their adversaries, but at the current moment, they're not fighting with each other. So it plants false information to make the Klingon and the Federation people go at each other over literally nothing. And like, I could be wrong, but I feel like that is way too similar of a situation to what happens in Day of the Red Doves to not be a reference to the Star Trek original series episode Day of the Dove.
That sounds close enough for me to call it a reference. I'm not familiar with that episode, but yeah.
I'm probably not wording it the best also, honestly, because I haven't watched a ton of Star Trek, so I'm not up on a lot of little details and stuff. And I've also, it's been a long ass time since I watched any original series episodes, but still. Anyway, it was just like, yeah, this has to be a reference. And I actually have this whole thing in my head where I'm like, when I have a moment of free time, I want to rewatch that episode of Star Trek, reread Day of the Red Doves, and like plot the two together and actually do like a TikTok video or something about it. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Because now we have to deal with the abomination. What? When I read this, I was just like, no. No, why? Why would you bring him back? There's enough bad people, bad guys. You know, there's enough conflict happening right now. Why do we need me, creepy Adrius, running around with his little data pad? And like, oh, God.
I agree, especially having read these well after Rise of Skywalker came out. Just the whole like, oh, really? It's okay. Having said that, I do like the way Piers is handling Abominatrix. I like the fact that, yeah, he's extremely screwed up and well on his way to psychosis, but right now he's a 10-year-old kid and doesn't know what's going on. He's hooked up with these people that he thinks are dumb. He's doing this because older him told him to, and because he's been fed this line. But even at this point, you could see where he's not sure that that's really what's going on, because if he was sure of himself, he wouldn't fall for Mustang's line as much as he does.
He's really a well-written plot monster.
Yeah, he really wants some acknowledgement that what he is doing, that he is being the best abominator as he can be. And
I will say, in episode 73, we introduced the, it was Xenophon all along. Yeah. No, it was Adrius all along. Yep, this happens a lot in this book. I need all of the Filk versions of who it was all along, because there's another one that's going to come up in our next episode for sure that I don't want to get into now.
Can we also just talk about how fucking gross everything between Lilith and Abominadrius is? Because it's really fucking gross.
The way she's trying to force an Oedipus complex on him?
She literally gave birth to this dude that she's been obsessed with.
I know.
And now she wants to fuck the child that she gave birth to. It's so gross on so many levels, and I hate every minute of it.
Look, people who have birth can do anything they want to, but if you're running a crime syndicate and trying to hold together a plot this incredibly intricate, why do you want to be pregnant for any of that?
Because Adrius ordered it.
Yeah.
The Jackal ordered it. Well, I mean, I don't know if he necessarily.
I don't think
Lilith carry him.
I don't think he did. I don't think he did that. No,
carry him, carry his clone. Oh,
he probably was just like, find a surrogate, and Lilith was like, "I heard you say me, and I am your favorite."
I like to think that on the video message, he's like, "Find a surrogate." Oh, you mean meet Lilith? I don't mean you. And in fact, I am telling you, find someone else, okay? You're fine. No, I don't think you're listening. Freak it up.
I'm sorry. What's that? What? I didn't hear you.
Get back to the plot.
Oh, God. Yes, exactly, though. Even Mustang is thinking about how Lilith always was obsessed with her brother, but the Jackal always preferred women like Antonia, these just heinous but gorgeous women. Listen, like, don't miss Antonia, that bitch, but Antonia wouldn't have carried the Jackal's clone.
Okay, my impression of Antonia is that she wouldn't have carried her husband's kids if she got married.
Yeah.
She would have been like, we are finding a surrogate or putting these kids into a test tube. I am not doing this.
She would probably want her own clone, honestly. The siblings of the women that we love. I guess also just this whole, I mean, you mentioned Seth already. There's clearly a part of Abominadrius that's like questioning what all is going on and how Lilith is and how the Bone Riders are acting. So he's the Jackal, but he's not, because he was raised a different way, right? He was raised a spoiled brat who, as Mustang says, I think more than once, didn't see enough of the outdoors. He was basically just raised up and trained to believe in everything that the Jackal believes. But also then there was Lilith over here acting like, but also I am the best. And also the Bone Riders are the best. And I don't know, I guess even despite what happens later, which we'll get into in a bit, I kind of wonder if there is a chance for him to not necessarily become a good person, okay? But he doesn't have the direct conflict with his father like the Jackal did. He doesn't have the knowledge that he, this particular child, was left out on the rocks to die. So we'll talk more about that when we get into his and Mustang's conversations, because the Bone Rider banquet, while upsetting, does give Mustang some of that intel that she needs.
She's disgusted watching them use so-called political enemies for fencing practice, but seeing their depravity, she's left wondering, how long could this ruse really last? My real brother loathed the Bone Riders. He mocked them behind their backs, but the best soldiers are often the hollow ones, whom you can fill with your own purpose. This clone doesn't know he's supposed to hate the Bone Riders. He was raised by a woman who worshipped the Jackal and the Bone Riders and thought the two inseparable. How disappointed the clones must be in the legends he was raised on.
Exactly. On top of that, lol, how stupid is Lilith for disobeying the clone's orders to leave Mustang's rooms exactly as they were? Did she really not believe that Mustang is Mustang and was going to very quickly figure out how to begin driving that wedge between the two of them?
I think it's partially that and partially the level of obsession that she has with Abominadrius. I basically think that she took the puzzles and masturbated to them.
Okay, that is a take.
That it says that she took them and like hid them away in her room.
Yes, I don't disagree that that might have happened, but I also think she took them away because she was afraid that Abominadris would put two and two together and was somehow dumb enough to think that Mustang wouldn't put two and two together.
Mm. Well, she's in this situation where she's been in charge. She's been running things, like, based on, you know, stuff that the Jackal told her to do. But she's been running things for a while now, except that she's been telling the clone that he's the mastermind behind all this, that he's the one who's really in charge, etc., etc. And now he's getting to the age where he can be like, well, yes, I am, because you've told me this is true. And she's still like, well, I still have the power to do this. And he's like, no, you don't. I have all the power. Why are you disobeying me? And she's not used to that yet.
Which is a great transition, because as a result of the conversation and her disobeying the orders, Mustang sees the Bone Rider's watch with smiles as the 10-year-old spanks maybe the hardest woman on all of Luna. And she just takes it. They all want to be number two. So there's the pack dynamic.
Mustang is just, she's just so smart.
Also, the level of kink in these chapters is wild.
Really, though, she figures out that Lilith hid the puzzles from the clone. She manipulates Abominadris into getting them returned to the wall of her office and then insisting on being alone with her. And then she also guides her conversation with him so that in the end, he's revealing so much more than she is. And now, granted, he is a 10-year-old child, but still.
He's a 10-year-old Abominadris, which I don't know, means he's the equivalent of a 13 to 14-year-old. Anyway. Okay, so anyway, Abominadris tells her the story about how Lilith took him to see cows slaughtered, and in response to Mustang asking if he hates Lilith, he says, "On the day she took me to see the cows die, I had a thought. I asked Lilith to build me an iron cow. She built me the iron wolf instead, as I knew she would. One day soon, I will melt her inside it." Mustang asks him why, and he replies, "Because she doesn't understand irony."
Fantastic voice for Abominadris. Yes, well it really done. Is.
So. Perfect.
I was like, can I hit the Antichrist? Let's see.
She doesn't understand irony.
Lol, wow, though. He already has like a plan in his mind of how he's going to kill the woman who carried him in her womb, which just speaks to this is, in fact, the Jackal, but also, wow, kiddo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I literally am like tearing up. I was laughing so hard.
The cloned acorns don't drop far from the psychotic oak. See, the thing is, honestly, I kind of... Now, Pierce was... I think he was smart not to do this, but in my mind, there's an alternate universe version where the Jackal is actually 13 to 14 years old. And we see stuff like, God, Mom! Stop telling me what to do and put the puzzles back, okay?
But to be honest, it is way more hilarious that he's just like steepling his fingers. Yes. He's like Mr. Burns in The Simpsons.
I'm so evil, Mother.
Yeah.
It's your turn for the wolf.
And now I will spank you.
Yes. Just as you did me.
She never spanked.
No, this child.
Absolutely not.
Yeah,
she never spanked him, though.
No. Absolutely not.
No, but oh my God, this is just, that kid is super ultra mega levels of creepy.
Yep.
I would love to see this on screen, because if they get the right kid, I can't imagine these books being made into live action and keeping a lot of the major points about the colors and everything. But if it was live action, oh man, they get the right person to play this child. That's going to be like an Emmy award-winning performance.
I hope they don't do live action, because I do not want to see a 10-year-old child spank a grown woman.
Well, he doesn't literally do it.
I know. But
thankfully, Mustang, again, is smart enough to turn things around.
Yes. And even though the clone realizes that Mustang sees him as an imposter at best, she doesn't disagree, telling him, "You're not wrong. If Adrius were here, he would be eating a lobster as he gave this lecture on a table containing the body of a conquered foe. If Adrius were here, he'd have sex slaves brought to him after the battle and fuck them on Octavia Alun's bed. And it would make him so very happy to dilute the most expensive liquor bottles with piss and then give them to his bone riders to share. And then after all of that, he'd tell it all to no one. His war on the world was a joke built around a central need to prove he didn't yearn for the approval from the only man who wouldn't give it. You, on the other hand, are just a joke built around me. A visitor to this world who doesn't belong. A ghost. And what Father was to Adrius, I am now to you. What a bad
hitting bit. With the hard truths. I almost worried that that was too much, but she's somehow able to play it off with the Night Lily. We heard about the Night Lilies in Lyria's chapters, actually, in Iron Gold, when she was meeting with the Yellow, who was breeding all these special flowers and stuff. He talks to her about the Night Lily. So this is a flashback to that. We have actually heard about them before. It's not the Iron Circle that just appears out of nowhere.
Yeah. I distinctly remember having gotten to this part and going, oh, the Night Lily.
Yeah. Oh, that description came back. That escape scene, though. How Mustang passes the flower to Adrius like a Bellona knight would. And he just grabs hold of it like a child would do. Now, to be fair, I feel like maybe I've just been lucky to be around very precocious 10-year-olds, but I don't really know that any of my nieces and nephews would grab hold at 10 years old. That's more of like a 5-year-old thing, but she does note that he hasn't spent enough time outdoors several times.
Well, and I mean, she also just did a bunch of provoking.
Yeah. Then he starts screaming, obviously. Lilith busts in. Mustang has to throw the flower at Lilith, and Lilith cuts off her own nose when the flower hits it to stop the poison. I mean, how do you... I know she has an axe, but that just...
I mean, really, that's knife work. You don't want an axe with that because you're gonna cut into your head.
Maybe she had a razor. Maybe, I honestly don't remember.
Maybe she had a really big nose.
True. I'm not cutting the background laugh out. Seriously, though. Yeah, she cuts off her own nose.
To spite her. No, that's all. I'm good.
Okay. Yeah. But it's only because Mustang got the puzzles put back and was able to press the one that opens the tunnel. And the tunnel goes to somewhere that somehow they haven't discovered yet that she does end up escaping. But it does suck so much that Mustang has to leave Severo, Clown, and Pebble behind.
Here's where my fears about mind control come back into play.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even want to think about it. It's something that it's gone round and round and round in fandom discussions. And every time I'm just like sick to my stomach thinking about Severo especially. But I guess like the only good news to come out of this is that clearly they don't know how to use the Pandemonium Chair and the Psycho Spikes the way Mustang knew. So how long will it take them to figure out? And maybe they never will. Ugh. Anyway, it sucks that she has to leave them behind, but they don't know where they're being kept, and she is critically injured. She got Lilith's hatchet to the back, I think, along with like a bunch of other wounds. She's not really being fair to herself when she thinks, is this what it comes down to? Leaving the best of my friends in the clutches of a ghost from my past? I suppose so. Severo was right. I am not Mustang any longer. I am the Sovereign. I feel very selfish as I crawl through the aperture into a small padded compartment large enough to fit 10. Listen, her having thoughts like this is part of why we love her so much, but for real, she is not being fair to herself in this instance.
She's right, but not in the way she thinks she is. She's not Mustang anymore. She's the Sovereign. She's got responsibilities that Mustang never had, and one of them is to try to fix this wholly fucked up situation, which she can't do if she's dead. And again, I'm going to say this, and I really, really hope some things. Without Virginia, I don't give the Republic forces much of a shot. Certainly not at putting things back together.
Yes, I agree that she needs to be around to fix things, but also in the condition that she was in, and they don't have any intel on where her friends are even being kept. It's like, what even are you going to do? I think that's the bigger reason why I disagree with her having the thought of like, I'm not Mustang anymore. I'm the Sovereign. Even if they knew exactly where they were, how could she possibly be part of saving them in the condition that she was in? She needed to get medical care. Period.
Even John McClane only had bleeding feet. Like, there's no way she's going to be able to sneak around the air ducts of the frickin' palace looking for her friends That's not.
She can't do a Die Hard, as they
yeah,
say.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She can't do a Die Hard. There's no way she's going to be able to send down a goon that says, ha ha ha, now I have a pulse rifle or whatever. It's just not going to work. Although,
particularly as where she ends up might have been a place that wasn't discovered by the enemy yet, but then she gets in the compartment anyway and is shot out to the escape area, and it turns out that that area is like a Vox Legion headquarters all of a sudden now, and they still need to send in Holiday and special force troops to extract her from that. So God only knows what else would have happened had she anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Mustang makes her way back to her home planet of Mars. And as she does, she remembers, on Mars, I was born and rode horses. On Mars, my eldest brother bled to death before Carnus Abalona. My mother jumped off a cliff. My father and best friend were killed by my twin. On Mars, I met my husband, but only my son waits below. It seems a lifetime ago that Darrow led my father's reign against our planet. How simple the world seemed then in the tunnel of our youth. Can it be wrong to feel nostalgic for a day of blood? Or was it the innocence I missed before we truly knew what turned the world? You had a clear goal.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying your goal's any less clear here. I am saying the path to victory is a lot more muddy.
That's the nicest way to put it.
Yeah. It reminds me of, oh my God, Dumb and Dumber. What are the odds that you'd go out with a guy like me? 1,000,000 to 1. So I have a chance. I'm like,
Beyond that, she might be welcomed back to Mars, but again, she doesn't feel great about it. After all, the Obsidian army and fleet might be gone. And sure, they left half the helium behind, which is a good thing. But Mustang can't help but focus on how she is the one who allowed the Obsidian to seize the continent of Samaria in hopes that they would call it home and defend it with their lives. And they ravaged it instead.
She asks Holiday, what does Mars mean to you?
Holiday, who, recall, is originally from Earth, hesitates before replying, hope. And you, my liege?
And Mustang simply tells her, war.
I mean, well, that's literally...
Yeah, I mean...
A little on the nose there, Mustang. Yeah. Mustang. Come on. Yeah. Come on. Gee.
War, but I mean, not in a Greek way, in a Roman way.
I guess Holiday... I don't know. I really don't understand how Holiday believes that it means hope right now, but...
Maybe that's because where things started. It's where things got kicked off. As much as they were still conducting business from Luna, it still seems to me to be the symbolic home of the Republic. Also, I know I wasn't here for these episodes. Just a quick note. I think the Obsidian plotline was probably the weakest point of this book. Okay, I'm done.
It's like a reverse Deus Ex Machina.
Demon Ex Machina.
Ooh, fancy.
Well, before heading out to see Pax and Victra, I guess, which, as we mentioned in the summary, Mustang was dreading, she visits with Kavix, who she sadly realizes is no longer the indestructible man who helped raise her, what with being shot by Volga, Thraxa going missing, and then losing Daxo. Oh, and P.S., the loss of Daxo is impounded by the fact that his body, along with those of the other slain senators, was cremated by the Vox, who then mixed the ashes into the sewers so that they couldn't be collected by their kin. Seriously, what the fuck, y'all? Kavix admits, sometimes the indignity is more than I can bear.
Mustang offers him a hand to help him rise, and... with a heavy sigh, the weary family man kisses his pet on the brow, takes my hand, rises, and transforms once more into my father's enforcer, the warrior giant of House Telemannus. Even I feel inclined to shiver. But it is a tragedy to see any man sacrifice his nature for his vocation, much less a man I love so much. To be what we need, what I need, he must go to war again. All his life he waited to pass the reins to his children, now so few are left. It is not how he thought it would be, but he endures.
And Kavix puts an arm around her shoulders and says, there is evil in us as there is good, but we do not regret our good as we do our evil. So we know what we are, my daughter. We know what we are.
Mustang pulls him closer and replies, we know what we are.
Listen, we're not crying, you're crying. Or maybe I'm not crying, you're not crying, I am crying. Kavix just, is there a bad... scene with Kavix in it ever? I honestly can't think of one.
Kavix is the best.
He's either being silly and hilarious and great, or he's being meaningful and deep and great. And every time he just has the perfect things to say.
If I was a larger human, I would 100% cosplay him.
Also, it's kind of Kavix to the rescue again once they land on Mars and Mustang sees Pax, because as we had mentioned, she believes she has to hold back from what she really wants, which is to, you know, actually act like a mother who is seeing her kid for the first time in months and months after he was fucking kidnapped. Because sigh, they're at war, and sigh, she's the sovereign and blah, blah, blah. But Kavix just breaks away, scoops up Pax, and crows about the kiddo's accomplishments. Gosh, we love him!
Though it is probably important to note that Mustang now sees his father's anger in Pax's eyes. Sure, her patience is still there, as is his own curiosity. But again, she notes that he has changed. I think we'll all just have to wait and see how much in the next book. Or at least hopefully we will. Ugh.
This is a point where I'm actually a little bit disappointed in Mustang. I think she made the wrong call.
1,000%.
Show him you're human right now. Show him you're human.
Yeah. And we talked about this a little bit in previous episodes where we've talked about Darrow and his relationship to Pax and even some of the things that he's thought in terms of relationship to Pax and how that's, it's just like some not great stuff about hiding in your emotions and not really being a father in a lot of ways. And I think this is a moment where, unfortunately, Mustang also kind of isn't being a human or a mother, like you said, when I think that would have really been the right thing to do.
Yeah, to show him that even if he as a, I mean, I know he's not a teenager yet, but he's been through some shit. So like, I imagine that if she had run up to him, if it had been her who ran up to him and not Kavix, that he would have been like, oh, gosh, mom. But mm-hmm. I do think that it was something that he needed in that moment that he wasn't given. And it just, you know, do better, parents.
Yeah,
be more like Kavix, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, it's like you already did the stuff where you had to be the sovereign earlier today when you left your friends. Again, mm-hmm. Right call. You made the right call, but you did that. You can have your moment here.
The thing is, she actually does way better with the next person she encounters that needs her to show her humanity. Because remember back in Morningstar when everyone was arguing against Victra being part of their councils and shit, and she ripped off her shirt to show her scars from Antonia's torture. Well, that scene is reflected when Victra is turning away from Mustang for abandoning Zebro, and Mustang removes her clothing to reveal the scars she received on Luna, whispering, "I tried, truly."
As we noted in the summary, Victra draws Mustang close and swears that if they can't save their men, they will have their vengeance. And Mustang knows. My husband would have it no other way. No matter what they say, Darrow is not dead. He endured for me, and I did not arrive. I will endure now until he does. Victra will have her wrath till her dying breath. I will have my hope. I will make our family whole again.
Endure my love.
Yeah.
I can't remember what episode that was. It was one of the Darrow episodes where he gets the note from Mustang, yeah. And it says, "Endure, my love. Endure." Oh,
comma placement's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, too fucking bad. Things just keep getting worse and worse, and now Earth has fallen as well. What the fuck? And that's just where we leave it. But it is time for our in memoriam section. The people who died in this part of the book. And to be honest, there's so many that we can't name all of them. And yet.
Yeah. I mean, if we could name all of them, we'd be here for, that'd be an entirely separate episode.
Mm-hmm.
Numerous members of Mustang's Lion Guard and her household, senators, Sky Hall officers, etc. Servilia Al-Arcos, Alexander's mom, apparently for the crime of being gold or some shit.
Theodora, who survived decades of sexual humiliation to become a glorified maid and then chose to follow Darrow simply because he was the first person to fight for her.
Min Min and the other howlers who were roasted alive in the Abomination's Iron Wolf, for certain suffering one of the worst deaths, if not the worst, of the series so far. May they be avenged by those who survive, that's for damn sure. As we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our Heroes Tier patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode will cover Lysander and Darrow's chapters from Part 4 of Dark Age, as they overlap to such an extent that it made basically no sense to split them up. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.